Hello there, this is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club of Australia, with the monthly news broadcast for members and friends of the club for March 2024. This month, instead of the usual broadcast, we will offer an historical broadcast from years past. The usual news and information will be broadcast next month. I'm Andrew, the VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. I have broadcast files going back as far as 2001. Many of the older files aren't the greatest as far as technical quality goes, archived in either Real Audio or Windows Media Audio format. These produced a smaller file size back in the days when the leading edge technology was dial-up internet. Remember that? This month we have an original broadcast from March 2002. Details on when to hear these news and information broadcasts are available at the club website, www.raotc.org.au. The VK3OTN is available on a wide range of radio platforms, HF, VHF and UHF, 2-metre repeaters, amateur television, DMR, that is digital mobile radio, and D-Star. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you miss the original news broadcast from the RAOTC website. If you'd like to contact the club, then why not send us an email, raotc@raotc.org.au. I hope you enjoy this month's broadcast.
Hi there, this is VK3AMD and Associated Relay Stations is VK3OTN for the Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club. Your committee is still working on various aspects of the procedure for the club to be incorporated. There are pages of print to be read and studied so that we can submit an application to the government for approval. We'll keep you informed. Here in Melbourne, the speaker at our luncheon on Tuesday, March the 12th, that's tomorrow week, will be Mr. Jim Karamalakis, who is the Senior Technical Officer in charge of the ACA's Testing and Measurement Laboratory here in Melbourne. He's very well qualified to talk to us about the forthcoming regulations about EMR, which will affect us all and be introduced very shortly. Members of clubs other than their own have been invited to come along for this one-off opportunity. The date, Tuesday, March the 12th, the time 12:30 for lunch at 1 p.m. The place is the Bentley Club, which is located in Yawler Street. That's Yawla, Yawler Street, Bentley. The cost is $27.50 for a very nice three-course meal with refreshments included. Bookings are essential. By Thursday next, March the 7th, with Arthur Evans, VK3VQ, at 2/237 Bluff Road, Sandringham, and his phone is 9584-7620. Production of our magazine OTN is underway, but it may be a few days later than usual. The RAAF Signals and Radar Association of South Australia will hold its annual Anzac Day reunion on Thursday, April the 18th at 12 noon for 12:30 lunch. Venue is the Marion Hotel in the Marion Road, Mitchell Park in near Adelaide. Booking should be made by April the 13th with either Jack Townsend, Ray Dean or Ron Coate. Just excuse me a moment. Next meeting of the VK6 group will be at the Bayswater Tavern next Tuesday, March the 12th, and we send good wishes from Melbourne to Clem, VK6CW. This is VK3OTN. New members. Today we welcome to membership Damien Vale, VK3RX, Associate Member Number 1239, Jeff Trasize, VK3CNX, Associate Member Number 1240, Eric Leach, VK5AFN, Member 1241, Don Benke, VK6BDF, a full member, Number 1243, and Doug Jackson, VK6ERF, full member 1243. The other one was VK42. If any of the chaps I've just named are listening today, it would be great if you identify yourselves and one or other of the callback sessions. And now it's with regret that I report to you the passing from us of Gordon Lennon, VK2AGL, who was member number 130, Ken Atkins, VK5MW, who was member number 1097, and John Gerber, VK1EG, member number 850, who passed away just on Saturday afternoon. We now pause for a few moments in memory of these departed friends. And this is VK3OTN for the Radio Amazon Travelers Club. In last month's broadcast, the story of the coastal station VIY at Mount Gambier received many comments and callback sessions from people like me who had never heard of its existence, although I copied Morse and VIM, and others back in the late 20s and early 30s. Other listeners had lived near or visited the site and were glad to hear about it. So please let us have more stories like this one. Another item that attracted attention was a story about bad tea. Lou Easterling, VK4BBL, has dropped us a note reading as follows. In last Monday's excellent broadcast, both in content and signal strength, there was a segment about bad tasting tea. It reminded me of a snippet in the now-defunct Electronica Australia of many long years ago when television had recently arrived. The radio branch in Hobart received a complaint from a viewer that ever since television had been installed, the tea had tasted funny. The investigating officer reported thus. The complainant lived at Sandy Bay and was dependent on tank water. His TV antenna had been positioned so that most of the elements protruded out over the roof gutter and the tank inlet. Being on the sea coast, they became a perching place for innumerable seagulls. The officer confirmed that the tea tasted very funny indeed. Thanks, Bruce. This is VK3OTN. Ron Fisher has summarized Pat Hawker's Technical Topics column published in the November 2001 issue of Retcom, the Journal of the RSGB. It tells of the work done by amateurs in developing the art of HF propagation forecasting. Many might be surprised that some of this happened in Australia during the 1960s and was published at the time in our own amateur radio magazine. Forecasting good HF conditions. Who would be a weather forecaster? Satellites with cloud cover pictures, radar, etc. have improved the art beyond all recognition, yet mistakes still occur. Still, meteorologists are well ahead of radio physicists. Despite some 60 years of radio propagation predictions, HF forecasts are still at the stage reached many years ago by weather forecasters. Not much better than a wet finger held in the wind. The trouble is, of course, the unpredictable sun. The physicists have built up much knowledge of its external workings, but still, as for earthquakes, have no reliable method of when and where or how powerful solar flares and the associated sunspots will occur. When pioneer amateurs began to explore the use of short waves in the early 1920s, the page was blank. Nobody knew what to expect at various wavelengths, at various seasons, or whether HF could provide reliable communications over various distances. The professional communications engineers, with the exception of Marconi and his chief assistant Franklin, had written off wavelengths below 200 meters as of little or no value. In 1912, the USA politicians had been content to hand over this entire region to the amateurs. The first transatlantic tests in the very early 1920s used wavelengths around 200 meters and needed darkness over the entire path. The first two-way contact between France and the USA was on about 110 metres. Amateurs first girdled a wave in October 1924 on about 80 metres around the dawn to dusk period. In the following experiments in 1924, John Reinhardt's W1XAM presented in April 1925 issue of QST an ionized reflecting layer hypothesis to account for the strange behavior of the short waves, in particular, the mysterious skip distance effect. But this was still only a theory. It was left to Edward Appleton to add to the QED. Appleton was Professor of Physics at King's College during 1924 and 1925 and was able to demonstrate the existence of a much higher layer than that assumed for the Heaviside layer. Appleton named this the F layer and showed that there were other intermediate layers which he named the D and E layers. This sparked off intensive investigations into the physics of the upper atmosphere remaining obscure. It took more than a decade before the connection between the ionized layers and the sun began to be understood in any depth. Even in the late 1930s, some amateurs were convinced of a direct connection between the quarter of the moon, the tides, the barometric pressure, and DX conditions for amateurs. The 28 megahertz band exercised a particular fascination. Many observed a hissing phenomenon thought to arise from atmospheric eruptions on the sun. In the 1940s, these radio emissions from the sun were to form the foundation of a whole new science of radio astronomy. This was investigated at the Cavendish Institute by Sir Martin Royal, G3CY, in the mid-1940s. Earlier than this, Dr. F.D. Farmer published an important paper, Critical Frequency Measurements of Wireless Waves Reflected Obliquely from the Ionosphere. That compared the F region skip frequency for transmissions between two distant stations with that calculated from the Norman coincidence characteristics on a simple ray theory. Frank Farmer, G6JY, is still an active amateur at over 90 years of age and is a regular 20-meter contact on Long Path most days. By the end of World War II, some at least of the effects of solar flares were becoming clear. But it was not until the 1960s that the importance of chordal hop and the associated grey line propagation, as well as trans-equatorial propagation, began to be observed and investigated and appreciated. Chordal hop was discovered largely due to the pioneering investigation of signals from Europe received in Australia by Hans Olbrecht, VK3AHH, later DL3EC. Hans published his findings in Amateur Radio magazine at the time. TE was discovered by amateurs on the North-South America path and then confirmed by observation on signals between Cyprus and Southern Rhodesia. Another well-known amateur who did much work on chordal hop was Les Moxon, G6XN. In the 60s and early 70s, Les took very low-power equipment to the mountains of Scotland, where he made contact with Australia using extremely low-angle radiation and chordal hop. Many amateurs have shown that with the aid of ionospheric tilts that occur at dawn and dusk, and even high-angle radiation from low dipoles can span many thousands of kilometers without intermediate ground reflection. Choosing the right time and frequency can give operators using simple equipment and very basic antennas plenty of DX. Amateurs can be proud of the role they have played in the investigation of HF and VHF propagation and should be aware that there is still plenty more to uncover. Things that might seem obvious to us perhaps should be noted, and over a period of time might lead to new discoveries. That was a very thoughtful contribution from Ron Fisher, VK3OM, after studying a very long and complex article. This is VK3OTN for the Radio Amateur Old Timers Club. We just mentioned Reinhardt's. Pre-war amateurs and some post-war amateurs will recall building a Reinhardt shortwave receiver. Some early post-war operators may also have done so. In the American magazine Ham Radio, issue dated August 1981, there was a 9-page article by Leonard Spencer, W6CBQ, entitled John L. Reinhardt, Father of Shortwave Radio. I'll read you some of the story and trace the later parts of it, so here goes. Between the years 1921 and 1925, John L. Reinhardt led the amateur radio experimenters of that time in development of shortwave communications below 200 meters wavelength. recognized engineers and scientists at that time considered these wavelengths useless. In 1964, Herbert Hoover, Jr., W6ZH, then president of the American Radio Relay League, awarded Mr. Reinartz the first Hiram Percy Maxim Gold Medal for the greatest contribution to amateur radio in the past 50 years. The ceremony took place on the 50th anniversary of QSD at the Pacific Division Convention in Sacramento, California. The actual presentation was made later at the Fort Howard Hospital as Reinartz was unable to attend the convention. Mr. Hoover summed up his address with this tribute to Reinartz, who was then retired and living in Aptos, California, and using the call sign K6BJ. And Mr. Hoover said, in the immediate scramble for short waves that followed his basic concepts, Reinartz's pioneering work became strangely overlooked. Perhaps the fact that he was an obscure electrician in a New England textile mill who had overturned the accepted theories of the scientific authorities of the day had something to do with it. But John Reinartz should not be forgotten. Quiet, modest, and unassuming as he may be, he, perhaps more than any other individual, is the father of shortwave radio. When we realize that today, 57 years later, and of course this was written in 1981, the great bulk of the world's long-distance radio communications, broadcast, point-to-point, marine, aviation, and all others, still takes place on those same short waves that were first demonstrated by Reinartz. We can justly be proud of this amateur's accomplishment. Now that's the end of Mr. Hoover's tribute to Reinartz, and now I'll tell you some more abstracts from that story. This is VK3ATN. During 1923 and 1924, Reinartz studied 5,000 reports on his shortwave transmissions to come up with the idea of skip distance and reflection from the Kennelly Heaviside layer, and predicted that communication across the nation in daylight would be possible. This was an entirely new concept at the time. In 1925, he was invited to cooperate with Zenith Radio in the provision of radio equipment for the Navy McMillan Arctic Expedition. He helped design and construct the shortwave station installed on the Bedouin, the schooner commanded by McMillan, and he was the radio operator on the ship. He went to work for RCA in 1933 to 1938 when he was called up for work in the US Navy. During his 5 years at RCA, the company filed 23 patents based on his work. In the Navy, he spent some time as head of the radio and radar division at the Naval Research Laboratories, where he supervised the work of 1,200 physicists. In 1940, he joined RCA, and then in 1949, he joined Eitel McCulloch, makers of the renowned IMAC tubes. He retired from there in 1960. Some of the calls he held were 1QP, 1XT, N1QP, W3RB, W3IBS, and K6BJ. When the article I've referred to was published in 1981, he was still active. What a man. There's an interesting story about a name just about all of us would have known in our early days of amateur radio. This is VK3AMD for VK3AGN. A few days ago, I received a phone call from a chap named Joe, who identified himself as Joe Martin, VK3DEK. Joe had read an issue of the Historical Radio Society's journal in which George Vance, VK3DS, was appealing for a black Kingsley AR-7 for the Army Signals Museum. He admitted he didn't have one, but knew quite a lot about them. He did indeed. When called up for Army service, he already had a first-class commercial operator certificate and was promptly drafted into the newly forming Army Special Wireless Group. When his unit set up operation in Greece, they were equipped with black AR-7s. The serial numbers were 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. How do you like that? I'm hoping Joe will tell us more about that story as time goes on. It won't be for lack of me asking you. This is VK3AMD. Next item from Certicito, the magazine of the Royal Australian Signals Association in Victoria. The writer's Don Jackson, who was in 6 Heavy Wireless Section 3 Core Signals. He calls his story The Battle of Aspro. It was in 1942, if my memory serves me, that it was decided to locate land headquarters direct operations during the anticipation in West Australia. The powers that be chose a secluded area inland north of Perth, which was eventually codenamed Aspro, and how apt this name turned out to be. Of course, wireless communication had to be assured, and with this in mind, a detachment was sent from 6 Heavy Wireless to ascertain whether communications could be maintained. Corporal Snowy was OC, and there were three other WT operators. We were issued with the famous, and some said infamous, 109 set. The tent was pitched, aerial connected, and test message sent. We worked a roster of 4-hour shifts. Communications were satisfactory when Snowy came on duty at 2400 hours. We'd been on ops with Snowy several times and had become quite used to seeing him with a blanket over his head and the phones overlapped. There we were, Snowy on the set, dimly lit by a low wattage bulb, and the rest of us bedded down for the night. About 0400 hours I woke and felt rain on my face, or was I dreaming? I hurriedly aroused the others. The tent was in an untidy heap 100 yards down the hill. Rain was pouring down, and Snowy was sitting at the 109, blanket over his head, phones on, fast asleep. How's communication, Snow? Oh, a bit of me, a dill at the other end, but otherwise not bad. On later off, Snowy became notorious for dropping off. Subsequently, this area became the site for LHQ and Signals Headquarters. The next time we saw it, we were most impressed. The engineers had done a wonderful job. Literally hollowed out the entire hill and divided the interior into rooms and passages, and over the lot was a huge camouflage net. It was truly amazing. We were allocated an area beneath the net, and it was proposed that our man was to be placed just so, but it had to be dug in. Armed with spades, shovels, pickaxes, crowbars, etc., we attacked the designated area, only to find that just under the soil was solid rock. We worked day after day to make headway through that rock, but hardly made an impression. We as Sikhs thought it was ridiculous, but our dear sergeant in charge said that we had to obey orders from above. Every night we were tired, exhausted, and frustrated. We were self-catered, i.e. bully beef and powdered egg, and some potatoes which we found in a nearby paddock. We took turns to be cook. My turn came around all too quickly, and I put the bully beef into a dixie, poured off the fat and grease, and covered the meat with mashed potatoes and mushrooms from another paddock. I was unanimously voted cook for the duration. Certainly beat bully beef and powdered egg. On retiring for the night, we took turns to read out loud our one and only book, 2 pages a night to stretch it out. One by one, we would drop off, listening to the adventures of Tom and Leonora. Believe me, some of the things that pair got up to would make your hair curl. Naturally, much head living went on. When it was at last realized we had no hope of burying our van, the engineers did the job with gelignite. That was from Certicito. Thanks for permission and reproducer. This is VK3AMD, VK3OTN. I don't know anybody who didn't enjoy the long strings of gobbledygook that came from Humphrey Appleby when addressing his Prime Minister Jim Hacker in the ageless BBC series Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister. Humphrey, Sir Nigel Hawthorne, died late in December. Paul Edenkin, who was Jim Hacker, had predeceased him. The back page section of the Melbourne Age, edited by Michael Smith with Victoria Gervich, reported the imaginary meeting of the famous pair when Humphrey arrived in heaven. With all credit to the Age and its brilliant writers, I'd like to read you some of the ensuing dialogue. Humphrey just arrived in heaven and faced St. Peter. Humphrey, good God, where am I? St. Peter, not quite, dear fellow, have a seat. Humphrey, that was one hell of a bandy jumbo port. It knocked me flat into the Chesterfield. St. Peter, into the other life, actually. Humphrey raising an eyebrow. What do you mean? I've got to be at a cabinet meeting at 4. Bernard? St. Peter, not so loud, Sir Humphrey. Most of the ex-ministers are sleeping. You see, we've been expecting you. And he consults a book. Ah, yes, your sponsor's coming along directly. He vanishes. Crash of thunder. Lightning. All goes dark. Enter on a cloud, Jim Hacken supporting a pair of magnificent angel's wings and pinstripe smock to a holy choir from a roseate glow. Humphrey aghast. You, Humphrey, what, Jim, Humphrey, what took you so long? Too many nights at the club? Or that meeting run overtime? Humphrey, I don't understand, Jim. You numb well? Jim said, Dylan, well, look who's talking. Humphrey said, oh. Then said Jim, well, well, I've never known you stuck for words. It's time I got even. To put it simply, Humphrey, certain informal discussions took place regarding your inclement and precarious state of well-being, involving a full and frank exchange of medical views, after which there arose a series of proposals that on active and inert examination proved to indicate certain promising lines of inquiry, which when pursued led to the realization that the alternative courses of action might in fact, in certain circumstances, be susceptible of discrete modification, leading to a reappraisal of the original areas of difference and pointing a way to encouraging possibilities of compromise and cooperation that, if bilaterally implemented with the appropriate give and take on both sides, might, if the climate were right, have a reasonable possibility in the end of the day of leading, rightly or wrongly, to a mutually satisfactory resolution. Unfortunately, these proved negative in all areas of possibility, resulting in inexorable and irreversible life return homeostasis, leading you from an oxygenated cerebral environment beyond all atmospheres and universal beings to a higher state of celestial being. Humphrey, what the hell are you talking about? Jim, you had a fatal heart attack and you're in heaven. Yes, well, the age right to that, Jim, they pay their apologies to Anthony J. and Jonathan Lynn, the creators of the original series. And on that happy note, I'll leave you to our next transmission on Monday, April the 1st. This is Alan Doble, BK3AMD, and Associated Relay Stations is BK3OTN, the official call sign of the Radio Amateur on Timeless Club in Australia. We now conclude our transmission for this month and have found it interesting. We'll be on the air again on Monday the 1st of April, and although that's April Fool's Day, we'll be there in earnest. And we'll be there again on the 6th of May at the same time as today, and daylight saving will have ended over here. Times and frequencies can be checked in the current issue, which is March 2002 of our club magazine OTN. Please take part in the callback session on the frequency you've been listening to. Thank you for listening. In 73, this is Alan Doble, it's VK3OTN, about to take calls on 2 metres. Please stand by.
You have been listening to VK3OTN. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia. This concludes this month's news and information bulletin. The next RAOTC news and information broadcast will take place on the first Monday of next month, on the same frequencies, and at the same times as today, with the exception of January. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks, where callbacks are taken. 73 everyone.